From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Obesity, we are told, is the scourge of health, linked to a large number of debilitating diseases such as diabetes or hypertension, heart disease, cancer, and more. For women especially, obesity comes with societal judgments rooted in notions of impossible skinniness. A new book examines how our attitudes toward obesity and fatness have been shaped by historical biases rooted in race and racism. In Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia, author Sabrina Strings writes, quote, racial discourse was deployed by elite Europeans and white Americans to create social distinctions between themselves and so-called greedy and fat racial others, end of quote. Sabrina Strings is an assistant professor of sociology at UC Irvine. She now joins me to discuss her new book. Welcome, Sabrina.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us. So this is such an interesting and fascinating book, and I'm wondering if you can take us through that history by telling us what got you interested in this topic in the first place. What led you to explore this idea that how we view obesity is rooted in the in this history?
This is a great question, actually, and it has a lot to do with my family history. So my family, like many other Black families, left the American South in the 1960s and traveled west as part of the Second Great Migration. And my grandmother, who grew up poor in a rural and segregated community, finally found herself in California in an integrated community. And she was amazed by the number of white women that she met who were on diets. And so she would constantly ask me, like in the 1990s when I was a kid, why are white women dying to be thin? You know, so it's something that she had been puzzling over for a couple of decades by that time. In the 1990s, I wasn't so interested in the question. I hadn't been inspired with the sociological imagination. But about 10 years later, when I was working in an HIV medication adherence clinic, actually in the Bay Area, in Bayview Hunters Point, I worked with two women who were HIV positive, each of whom were not interested in taking their medications because of the fear of gaining weight.
Wow.
Yeah. And to me, that was staggering because the stakes were literally life and death. And yet they were willing to risk death in order to remain slender. And so I thought, my grandmother's question that she had been asking for so many years, this is actually very important. We don't quite know why it is that women in America, and historically, particularly white women, are so devoted to being slender. So I wanted to dig into the root of that particular phenomenon.
And so what you found was this goes back to the, in a way, origins of this nation and, of course, the history of the slave trade, right?
Yes. And that was not something I was expecting. In fact, when I began the study, there were a lot of questions about what happened after the 1950s, because people are well aware of the fact that there was this moment in which more curvaceous physiques were being prized in America. However, I decided that I wanted to find out when did this transition take place in the Western world, where we know this is value, not just in America, but throughout most Western nations. And so I went back to the moment in which curvaceous physiques were prized. So during the Renaissance, in which we have all of these paintings of voluptuous women. And I traveled from that moment to the early 20th century, which was the time period in which scholars had identified that in the United States, the slender aesthetic had taken hold. And what I found was that there were two things that were important. First was the triangle slave trade, as slavery went on between the 17th and 18th centuries, skin color became less of a valuable mechanism of sorting people into either enslaved or free positions, because obviously of the ongoing interracial mating between the races and the colonies. Mm-hmm. And so what they decided was that they needed to identify other characteristics that could prove that one was either of the elite white race or the lower Black race. And what they deemed was that, well, Black people are actually more sensual, right? This is a stereotype that many of us are already familiar with, but I suppose we haven't really thought about all of its implications. Not only did they believe that Africans were more prone to excess sexuality, but also excess orality, so overeating, which they claimed led them to be fat.
So this story of a woman named Sarah Bartman is important to this history as well. And you write about her. She was referred to as the Hottentot Venus. Tell us about this particular ugly chapter in the history of race and racism, particularly as the United, as it sort of appeared in those colonial nations, including the United States.
Sarah Bartman ends up being an important person because, as I was mentioning earlier, a lot of the discourse surrounding fat Black bodies, denigrating African people for being too invested in the oral appetite, was largely taking place in the colonies. And there were some reports of this phenomenon of what they might have deemed like the art of feeding in various African nations. Some of that information was being transmitted to various parts of Western nations. But many Western countries, in Europe in particular, didn't actually have a large African population. And so they used a couple of colonists, actually used Sarah Bartman as a lightning rod, as a visual example of what Africans prized. So purportedly Africans prized eating and they prized fat bodies. And so they brought Sarah to France and also to England and put her on display as an example of the ideal archetype of Black aesthetics. And some of the bills that included her image would suggest that she was 3 yards and 3/4 round. That was supposed to be one of the draws.
Wow. So, of course, this then leads to this whole notion of how Black women's bodies were also so severely objectified, right? Which then goes hand in hand with the dehumanization that is required to justify enslavement.
That's absolutely right.
Let's talk about how men and the aesthetic around men's bodies developed at that time. Was there a discussion around that, or was it mostly centered around women's bodies?
You know, it was interesting because when the slender aesthetic took off, or more accurately, when the trend towards slenderness took off, it really wasn't about appearances. A lot of men in the late 17th and early 18th centuries actually decided that being slender was evidence of having a particular mental agility. So these were men who thought we are devoted to the life of the mind. And there's some disconnect in their minds between individuals who are given up to the sensuous pleasures of life and those people who are, quote, hard students. And so when slenderness really started to be a phenomenon in places like England, it was mostly elite men who were engaging in the trend of slimming down in order to prove that they were true intellectuals.
But you also had some historical moments around celebrating more curvaceous women's bodies, right? We hear the term Rubenesque, which refers to the artist Rubens, whom you write about. What did that represent? What did that particular art aesthetic represent?
So in the Renaissance, there was this clear evaluation of thick physiques over thin physiques. And so there were all of these discussions of how beautiful, voluptuous women were. And then by the time that Peter Paul Rubens came along, which was about 100 years into what might have been considered the Renaissance era, he would draw women with beautiful, curvaceous figures. But he would also suggest that for him, the height of beauty were women whose skin was, quote, white as snow. So he actually becomes a very important person in the history of aesthetics because he picked up on the high valuation of curvaceous and voluptuous physiques, but he suggested in what would have been considered the proto-racist era that actually white skin is what really brought curvaceous physiques to their epitome of beauty.
So this is almost an opposite of then what took place later, where slenderness and whiteness were intertwined and obesity was more linked to the non-white.
Exactly. And this is how we can understand that race is not in any way rooted in reality, right? It's all about trying to understand how we might be able to make claims about a group of people in order to keep them oppressed. So what took place after about the 16th to 17th century is that you see that there's a shift in the understanding of race, such that previously there might have been a discourse of African behavior and African appearance. But during the height of the slave trade, there starts to be a proliferation of ideas surrounding how people looked in various regions. And so by the time that Peter Paul Rubens was drawing his women, who are sort of now we call them Rubenesque, obviously, but with what he would have said is undulating curves. There was the idea that Black women were small. They were little, in fact. They were little in height and also in weight. They were scrawny. That's how they were being represented. And it wasn't until there was this new proliferation of discourse in the 18th century which suggested, actually, there are certain places where you can find small Black women. But in the sub-Saharan African region, you're going to find women who are invested in overfeeding, and therefore they're going to be rather large in body.
So today, our ideas around obesity are steeped with concerns for health, right? And there's a lot that we can talk about there, which I hope we have time to get to. But did historical notions of obesity and fatness also find justification from so-called scientific ideas? We know we have a history in this country of racializing science to justify racism. And I'm wondering if that was also true around conversations around body size.
When you look at the United States in particular, we notice that the medical establishment really coalesced in the late 19th or early 20th centuries. And at that time, there was this great concern that people in America were underweight. And so what they wanted to do was try to encourage people to actually gain weight. Because of the, quote, Yankee stereotype was someone who was tall and lanky, just like Abraham Lincoln. Mm. So it wasn't until the early 20th century that this relationship that we are now so familiar with of fat and, quote, unquote, adverse health risks started to be promoted in the medical establishment.
So we today have this obsession with, you know, weight, and not, and I say, when I say today, I mean today, maybe over the past century in particular, where women in particular have our bodies policed in very severe ways that impact our mental health. Do we, and we have studies that show that, certainly things like body mass index can be directly linked to debilitating diseases. But then there are other studies that sort of contradict that and suggest that our fear of obesity might be overblown, and that, you know, women who might actually qualify as obese sometimes have higher life expectancy than those who have the right BMI. So there's a lot of confusion around that. Do you find that we're still in a place where our society deems that fatness and obesity is inextricably linked with non-whiteness?
I do think that that's where we are currently, although I hope that my book will be one of the resources for people who are challenging those notions. What I'm investigating in the book is the way in which BMI was introduced by a man named Ansel Keys in the 1970s, and also mid-1980s actually was when it really took off. But it was introduced largely as a what was called an arbitrary mechanism for being able to determine the relationship between weight and health. So it was very clear that there was not a whole lot of science supporting the utilization of BMI or body mass index as a measure of health outcomes. Nevertheless, it was presented as some type of innovation within the medical community that would supposedly make it easy for them to make determinations about who was and who was not healthy. Of course, now we understand that BMI is mostly a useless tool. There are many studies that contradict the findings that somehow having a BMI of 30 or greater inevitably leads to poor health outcomes. But as you mentioned, it continues to be used. And so part of what we're having to push back against is the utilization of a measure that is not truly helpful to communities. And as other scholars have also pointed out, in reality, when we use BMI, we can sometimes contribute to poor health outcomes for those individuals who are, quote, obese by its measure, because of the fact that it tends to stigmatize.
You also, in your book, write about another historical figure, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, and how his contributions also helped to further this misconception of links between obesity and race. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yes, we know about John Harvey Kellogg, actually, because he is the founder of the Kellogg brand of cereal, right? So many of us are probably unaware of the fact that he was a well-known doctor. So he trained under some of the most respected doctors of the day. He published in top-flight journals, JAMA, AJPH. And so what he believed was that, again, American women were too slender, going back to this whole stereotype of the Yankee approximating the sort of like tall, lanky figure of Abraham Lincoln. And so he said, okay, Americans can gain weight, and especially the women can stand to put on a few pounds. And this is what he was pushing for. For him, his concern was white women. He was not so much concerned about what black women were doing because in his mind, well, the lower races are going to die off eventually. He actually wrote about that in some, again, top flight journals. Yes, right. So this is a hidden history for sure. So in his estimation, it was important to get white women to gain weight. So it wasn't until the 20th century, around about the 1920s, that some doctors started to push back against this view. And when they did so, it wasn't mostly relying on scientific findings. It was relying on insurance tables, which suggested that policyholders who were slimmer had longer life expectancies. Now, of course, policyholders in the 1920s are a far cry from a representative sample of Americans. Nevertheless, these tables were being used to suggest that instead of gaining weight, Americans focus on keeping their weights down.
We today also, you know, women feel so much shame around their bodies, around the images of their bodies, in huge part perpetuated by media images and the photoshopped, images of skinny, largely white women on magazine covers who, you know, we're supposed to aspire to. We're supposed to aspire towards, you know, having our ribs sticking out and our clavicles showing and having narrow hips and, you know, essentially the body aesthetic of a young boy rather than an adult woman. Is there a history there that is also rooted in these racial notions of body image, because magazines have been around for a long time in America?
Magazines were an important proponent of this trend, as it turns out. So as colonists were suggesting that there was a relationship between fatness and blackness, and since fatness was evidence of low racial standing, slenderness, its contrast, was supposed to be representative of elite racial standing. And therefore, as early as the 1830s, you see a lot of magazines in the United States, in particular, suggesting that white women should focus on losing weight. So you might have noticed that I was talking about the medical establishment suggesting that they needed to gain weight in the 19th century. Mm. Well, it's largely because magazines had been telling women for so many years that they needed to remain slender, not just to prove racial superiority, but also religious propriety. There was a lot of conversation surrounding Protestantism and temperance and what it means to be an elite white Anglo-Saxon Protestant woman.
Right, because that notion that when one is obese, it's a sign of gluttony and therefore antithetical to the Protestant ideal, those also pervaded our society.
Yes, I think right now we've moved away from a lot of discussions of Christianity, but of course, Christianity was an important principle for the founders of this nation. Many of them identified as Christian, if not all of them, from various sort of different lineages. And so what they had was this very clear idea about what it meant to be an Anglo-Saxon, what it meant to be a Protestant, and those converged in many respects, evidently, but the question of how the body should appear, that was one of the ways in which whiteness and Protestantism were very clear. The people who are the most elite should be slender. It's proof of the ability to remain dedicated and focused on God. And it's also proof of the ability to have the self-control and rationality that's needed of those who sit atop the racial hierarchy.
So let's fast forward to what you think needs to happen today. We would like to think that with our much better understanding of race, especially race as a social construct, a better understanding of science and how the body actually works, that we would take a purely science-based approach to the connection between good health and one's body, one's weight. What needs to happen, aside from trying to understand this history that you write about, that you would like to see in the medical community and also in our, you know, social sphere?
I'd like to see the medical community moving past the idea that we need to try to identify the precise amount of weight that we simply will not allow. I think so many of the conversations surrounding first the weight tables about what was normal weight or standard weight, and then later BMI, which shifted many different times determining whether or not it should be between 18 to 30 or 18 to 25, et cetera, all of this was trying to identify what would be acceptable weight. We need to move past that idea entirely. If we are focused on creating a community in which all individuals can be healthy, that's what we should do. We should try to find mechanisms to give people resources to eat healthy food, resources to be able to walk within their communities, clean drinking water, fresh air. All of these things contribute to better health outcomes.
So rather than police individuals and punish them, you're suggesting just creating environments where people can thrive.
That's precisely right. And the Bay Area is an important place where the Health at Every Size movement is going on, where people are saying, look, for a long time, we've been told to lose weight. That doesn't work, and it stigmatizes people. Instead, we should just focus on giving people the resources that they need to lead healthy lives.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Sabrina, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, Ali. It's been my pleasure.
My guest has been Sabrina Strings. She is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. And we've been discussing her new book, Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.